And welcome back to This Green Earth here on KPCW Park City. We are now turning our attention to the hidden bonds that tie our natural world together with award-winning author Sophie Pavel. Pavel's latest book is To Have or to Hold, Nature's Hidden Relationships. The book takes readers on explorations of nature's symbiotic relationships. Sophie, thank you so much for joining me today on This Green Earth.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
I first just want to set the stage and get to know you a little bit better. This is your second book that explores environmental themes. The first was the highly acclaimed Forget Me Not, which shares the stories of endangered species, and it's brilliantly done in a way that blends both education and what is actually happening with some humor. So share with us your background and what led you to writing these books.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I mean, there's never a conventional way to writing a book. And certainly for me, writing a book was never part of my plan. So it's always a surprise to me to be doing interviews like this and talking about the books because it still feels quite surreal. My background, I was actually born in the States. I was born in Augusta, Georgia. And then we moved to the UK when I was 4 years old. And so I was very much raised here, but still feel very connected to my American roots. I still have close family out there and love to still kind of say that I'm American. But I was brought up in a really beautiful part of England in a county called Devon in the southwest near the coast. And it was really that childhood of spending lots of time outside in different environments and all different kinds of weathers that really gave me an appreciation for not just spending time outside, but also just the experience of it, how it made me feel, the emotion attached to it, the nostalgia. And so that passion for adventure and the unknown and just kind of exploring nature in all her hidden corners and mysteries led me to study zoology at university. And then later I did a master's in science communication. And it was in that master's really that I got to know the power of storytelling in science and in as a form of communicating science and helping the public to understand, you know, what's important, what's captivating, what's magical, what's concerning and important for us to know. And that kind of kick-started my career, I suppose, and doing science communication across multimedia, and whether that's on digital platforms or through script writing for films and articles, reports, journalism. And the whole book thing kind of came to me, I guess, by way of a surprise, in that an article I wrote for a newspaper was picked up by a publisher, and then it kind of went from there. But I feel very grateful for the platform that writing books has allowed me to do, and I take it very seriously in terms of it being hopefully a tool to try and tell important stories about our planet and help people connect with it in new and exciting ways, because it certainly helped me do that.
Well, we are grateful that you picked up that pen and began to write because your books are wonderful. And I want to turn the lens on this latest book, To Have or to Hold, which explores 8 symbiotic relationships that illustrate nature's interconnectedness. Now, these relationships are already so layered and interesting, but you are also adding this layer of a volatile and ever-changing climate to that as well. So we're going to dive into some of these examples, but first let's start with the basics. And how would you define symbiotic? What is a symbiotic relationship?
So it's a tricky one, and it's a term that I remember learning about when I was at college. But having looked at it again for 3 years, 3 years of research went into building this book, I realized that actually it's so easily misunderstood. And it's kind of a term that can take many different directions and in many ways reflects the nature of these relationships and the nature of our planet and how the world works and how species interact. And so loosely, symbiosis describes the kind of amazing, confusing situation where completely different species, whether that's plants and animals or fungi or both, come together and live together, either for some of or all of their lives in order to survive. And so there is a fundamental reason that they come together. But the nature of that coming together and that interaction is very ancient, it's very established, and it's kind of like this mesmerizing flux of give and take where it's almost impossible to determine which species is getting what out of the relationship, if anything. But what's amazing is that as soon as you start to get your eye in and have your radar on for symbiosis, it's pinging all the time. Symbiosis is the fabric of every single ecosystem because, as the famous conservationist John Muir said, I think, like, if you pick one species, you'll find it's hitched to everything else in the universe. And that's exactly what symbiosis is. It helps us understand, as you said, the interconnectedness of everything and how life is so entangled, but in a very kind of strong and visceral way. And there's so much that we can learn from how nature does that.
Now, when we talk about these relationships, one of the most dominant is a parasitic relationship. Is it true that about 50% of all animal life is dependent on parasitism in some way?
Yeah, absolutely. So parasitism is symbiosis in its kind of most ubiquitous form. And it simply involves the suffering of one member of the relationship enabling or furthering the survival of the other. And it's not a strict, two participant relationship. There could be three, there could be four, there could be even five for a bee. Nature's so complicated. But yeah, parasitism is everywhere again. And it allowed me to really explore the cultural problem that we have with not just parasites as a way of life, but also just as a word, as a way to describe something or someone. And it's always in a negative form, but parasitism in nature is fundamental to how thousands and tens of thousands of species survive. And so, again, learning from them offered many quite hard-hitting lessons for us as to how we go about our relationship, not just with nature, but with one another as well.
Yeah, we can turn the lens back on ourselves a lot. I think that one of the things that comes to mind when I think of parasitism, you talk about the terms of grotesque and glamorous, and perhaps grotesque can be something that thrives off decay or the demise of another. So, can we talk about some of the ick factor that this brings into humans? I think we very much look at it as maybe a little grotesque or gross, but really it's just nature playing out. So, that label isn't truly fair. But can you give me some examples? Because you do have some in the book that it's a little skin crawly, I guess.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And like, I had so much fun writing those chapters that included parasites like the saculina barnacle and the hairworm that are just the most like quintessential parasites that anyone would think of and feel grossed out by. So I mentioned the hairworm. That is a species of worm. And I was looking at a freshwater hairworm and they look how they sound. They look kind of no thinner than a strand of hair from your head. And they live in water and they kind of cycle through life, living and dying in water. It's crucial for their survival. And actually, it was interesting in realizing how much of symbiosis cycles through water in this way, and in many ways behaves in kind of slippery, volatile, but very much like sustaining life-giving ways, like water itself. But hairworms are unique in that they rely on multiple hosts to survive. Actually, well, many parasites do that, but hairworms do it to the extreme. And so they begin life in fresh water as a tiny egg, and then they hope to be eaten by something like a snail. And then within that snail, they will grow and kind of bide their time for a bit. And then they will hope that that snail will be eaten by something else, maybe a cricket or a grasshopper or a beetle. And then it's within that larger host that the hairworm kind of gets to work and is able to grow and grow and grow into sometimes a worm that may be like 10 to 20 to 30 centimeters long, buried inside the head area of these host insects. And it's within here in the kind of nerve region of the brain that they instruct this host to do the impossible, which is to walk back and leap into fresh water again. And if it's a grasshopper or a cricket, the last thing they will ever want to do is return or even go anywhere near water if they're, land crickets who love long grass and they don't want to get wet. And so somehow this worm manages to turn them into a zombie. And we've all seen videos of nature doing strange things and zombies doing crazy things. And this happens in real life. And it's controlled by this tiny worm in the head of this cricket instructing the cricket to leap back into fresh water so the worm can then spill out from the head of the insect and find a mate and kind of begin the whole cycle again. And you can see videos of this. It's very accessible and people are so freaked out by it. And, you know, for good reason, it is crazy. But what's amazing is that if you see a stretch of fresh water in a river or anywhere near a lake or a wetland, and they have a good population of hairworms, you can be pretty sure that that water quality is good, because these worms rely on high oxygenated, fast running water, and they tie the lives of so many different species in an aquatic ecosystem together. And so they're a good indicator as to whether or not a river or a freshwater habitat might be healthy. And I think it's an example of where it's the species who are grotesque or have lifestyles that we may not agree with or feel creeped out by that often are so crucial to nature surviving and thriving. And so it's a reminder, I guess, to pay attention and to look again at the things that might scare us and maybe give ourselves a moment to try and feel that kind of wonder and fascination that we definitely have capacity to feel.
Yes, there's a vast amount of fascination to the natural world, and there's such an importance to these symbiotic relationships to the greater good of biodiversity and healthy ecosystems. So in writing this book and finding these different relationships, what would you say overarchingly is important for humans to understand or take away when we look at these relationships? What are some of those bigger lessons that you learned?
Well, I think one of the main ones is that in every interaction that species have with one another, there is very little evidence, if any, to show that there is overexploitation and extraction that is unsustainable. So, for example, when we look at parasites, it's in a parasite's best interest to keep the host alive, and in some cases even thriving, so that the parasite can continue to take the resources that they need from their host in order to complete their own life cycle. So if the host dies in the process or is dying and decaying, the parasite's not going to be well nourished. It's going to have a poor chance of survival. And so I think in the research that I did, and I spoke to many of the world leading experts in these topic areas about this, and they were in agreement, is that actually parasites exercise a phenomenal amount of restraint in basically taking what they need. And it's a term known as reciprocity in exploitation. So in a symbiosis, it's not kind of happy clappy, mutualistic, everybody gets something. It's a bit more nuanced than that, and it's much more complicated. But what it seems to be is that there's this, as I said at the beginning, this kind of flux of give and take. So if we then zoom out to look at our relationship with nature and kind of how we go about extracting resources and exploiting habitats and communities, whether that's, human communities or more than human communities in the living world and in across species, there's a lot that we can assess and interrogate as to, well, maybe we can be a bit more like nature. Dare I say, maybe we can be a bit more like parasites in terms of taking only what we need and leaving some for everyone else. And so I think that was a big takeaway for me, because these relationships have existed for millions of years in a sustainable way with this model. And so could we forge a more sustainable future by adopting some of the strategies that nature has? And I think the other takeaway was just that, we're never alone. Our bodies ourselves are occupied by hundreds of parasites that do all sorts of tasks and activities and daily things that we are not even aware of, but we would know if they weren't there, because we wouldn't be alive. So I think it's a sense of, hopefully, a sense of reassurance, and that we are part of this huge, complex, multidimensional web of life that is very resilient, is very adaptable, is highly intelligent. And so if we pay attention to that and lean into it, hopefully our relationship with nature can be one for the better.
Right. And humans can be quite extractive in the way that we approach the natural world, in a way that we see the natural world as being almost at our bidding instead of being a part of it. It's for our gain. And I love the understanding of how humans can act in parasitic ways But if we're doing it correctly, the way that the natural world does it, then we won't be so much of a pressure on the very thing that keeps us alive.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's becoming comfortable with that uncomfortable truth that we are a parasite and actually we're not a very good one. Because if we were a good one, then our host, i.e. the planet, would be thriving in a much better state than it is currently. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's, as I said, nature's so adaptable. And if given the space and the opportunity, it can bounce back and surprise us all. And so we are totally able to take that step back and reassess. I just hope that, you know, it's we make good choices with the options that we have.
Right. And as we're seeing the effects of climate change, when you were writing this and looking at these different species and parasites, how are they being affected by our changing climate?
Yeah, so this was really important for me. I think, like, I would never write a book now if climate change wasn't an integral part of the narrative, because it's an integral part of our everyday narrative in real life. And so it would be, you know, it's a non-negotiable addition to any book for me. But I was particularly interested in looking at climate change from this perspective, because these relationships are so established and ancient and kind of ingrained in the way that the natural world works. And yet they are facing currently a medley of threats due to climate change that they have not yet encountered or prepared for. And I'm talking about human-induced climate change here. So obviously the world has cycled through eras of huge climatic change, but this era of industrialization and fossil fuels and related impacts and human pressure has not been encountered before. And so the pressure's on to figure out, you know, well, actually, how are these relationships coping? Is this enough of a threat to kind of sever these ancient bonds and break up the relationship? Or is it actually changing the relationship into a kind of new form or a new beast, and that it's bringing new participants onto the scene, or it's moving species around? And there's lots of evidence to suggest that. But one of the most striking things that played on my mind a lot was going back to the hairworm. I mentioned how they guide, or they manipulate their host to return to fresh water. And the big question was, well, how do they navigate in the head of the host? And many studies they're still trying to find this out. There's lots of questions around it, but it's been suggested that maybe they navigate in the dark and use the cues from like the moon and the stars and reflected celestial light at nighttime to find water bodies. So the moon reflected off water would signal where water is. And yet we live in an era where 80% of the world at night is lit artificially by anthropogenic light, street lights, car lights, industrial lights, city lights. And then when you throw in sound as well and sound pollution, I think there was a study that showed that like 60% of places in Europe have a background noise level that's equivalent to the sound of constant rainfall. So we have so much human distraction out there, and nature hasn't had time to evolve ways to mitigate the effects that that might have. And so when animals have evolved to navigate in the dark, hunt in the dark, listen in quiet spaces, and that's now being interrupted by man-made light and sound, it's kind of difficult to imagine how that could go well for some of these species. And so there's lots of unknowns, but there is a lot of hope as well. And I think that was really important for me to include throughout the stories, is we're just kind of on a fact-finding mission at the moment. And it's a really exciting time to be trying to kind of address these concerns and to find things out and to speak to people who are doing amazing research to try and find some of these answers was really hopeful and inspiring. So it's not all doom and gloom, that's for sure.
Well, I'm glad that you said that, because we do talk a lot about alarming changes in our world here on the show, but we do like to always end with pieces or pockets of hope. So in writing this book, why the title To Have or To Hold? Can you share with me what that title means to you?
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you for asking that, because I always enjoy answering this question. It's one of those things that you put a lot of thought into when you're planning the book and kind of figuring out what it's going to be. And then you hope that maybe a reader or two might figure it out and be like, oh, that's why it's called that. So To Have or To Hold is a play on the traditional like marriage vow in Western cultures, to have and to hold. But by changing the and to or, it kind of is a bit destabilizing, and it kind of disrupts the certainty of that vow, of that promise to kind of stay together forever. And so it was coincidental that at the time I was researching and writing this book, I also got married. And so I guess that vow was on my mind, and my thoughts were in that headspace. And so I suddenly started to think, well, actually, symbiosis, as it's taught, is like very easily academic. It exists a lot in textbooks and can be very dense as a topic to kind of wade through. And so in an attempt to lighten that density and bring it to more of the public domain in a way that hopefully anyone, whether you have a scientific background or interest or not, can hopefully understand and feel engaged with, I thought, well, actually, if we wrap symbiosis in kind of a metaphor of a kind of marriage with nature and all the kind of natural give and take and compromise and highs and lows that comes with that in a very human way, maybe it will help us reconnect with nature in a way that makes us kind of view it as something to love and to cherish. And hopefully it just allows us to like pause and question our own relationship with nature.
And I think questioning is always the key there. I love that you said that. Just questioning our intents or reactions to nature and questioning how we show up as humans. When you were collecting all this data, you had mentioned that it seems vast. It seems like a lot to wade through. I'm sure a lot hit the cutting room floor. How did you decide what to put into the book?
Well, I wanted to pick relationships that illustrated various things. So I wanted relationships that would, A, allow me to travel and visit different varied habitats across the British Isles. So all eight relationships I've chosen are around the British Isles, but they have global significance. And so many of the kind of conclusions and the research and the discussion is very much of a global context. But I wanted to travel to try and find some of them in the wild via low carbon means. So whether that was getting trains or boats or riding my bike, trying to be mindful of my footprint in that regard. And it was also just more fun and adventurous, and I enjoy indulging in that sort of thing. So I wanted species that would take me to different places and try and represent the British Isles as best I could in all its variety. And I wanted species that had a wealth of scientific research behind them, so that I could feel like that my arguments were credible and I could track down and speak with the experts who are researching them at the moment. So it felt current and kind of solid in that way. And I also wanted species that would kind of surprise and delight, but then also shock and maybe frighten readers, because I think, you know, ultimately you kind of want to be an entertainer as well as a communicator. And certainly there were species who I think helped me do that. But yeah, it was very tricky, because as soon as you select your chosen relationships and then you speak to Professor so-and-so, who's an expert in crabs, and he suggests like three other relationships that sound amazing, and so you want to do them. So you have to be quite ruthless and settled in your choice. But you know, symbiosis is everywhere, so there is definitely more for others, but it would be risking drawing the same conclusions, I think, but we'll see.
Well, the book is quite fascinating. It is To Have or To Hold: Nature's Hidden Relationships. What can people do to learn more about you? Do you have a website?
Oh, thank you. So I do have a website. I do need to update it, but it's just sophiepavel.com. I'm also on Instagram and Substack. So I post like writing experiments and essays and things on Substack, and I'm enjoying that. And then in terms of buying the book, you can buy it wherever you buy books, really. It was published in the US last summer. And so you can buy it through Barnes and Noble or through independent booksellers, I'd recommend.
And what is next for you? Are you working on a new book? Or are you taking a break for a while?
Well, I did want to take a break for a while, and I kind of did, but the trouble is I really love writing, and so I'm writing again, but I've got some magazine commissions and things, and the book's out in paperback this year, so I'm going to be focusing on that again. But I'm working on a new book proposal in February, but it's a very different kind of thing for me. It's a different format, but it's still very much to do with climate change and sharing kind of overlooked stories about nature. So I'm excited about it, but it does feel like a big challenge again. We'll see. But writing and reading and trying to get outside is what I'm doing.
There you go. Well, Sophie Pavel, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you. Again, the book is called To Have or to Hold: Nature's Hidden Relationships, and you can get it wherever books are sold. And we hope that you do, because it is quite a read.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to be on, and I'm really grateful.
Well, we appreciate you being part of this green earth. Thank you so much, Sophie.